It's working. So last week I was at Costco and I was shopping, and there were two young men, Costco employees, having a very animated discussion near where I was. They were putting up a display or something. I wasn't really listening until one of them said very clearly, "I think I need a hand on this journey called life." And that made me smile when I heard that. I think I need a hand on this journey called life. And we need a hand. We all need a hand. We need many hands. And fortunately, there are actually many hands available to us on this journey called life. That's why everyone is here today, why you come to meditation or a center like this. So we need a hand figuring out who we are, what's going on here. From my view, my version of the First Noble Truth, human life is really hard at times. And it's complicated. And it can be confounding. It can be scary. It can be overwhelming. So we do need support and guidance and understanding. And one of those ways, one of those helping hands, is to have a map of a provisional view of the path. I call it provisional because no view and no map is actually correct, and we can actually update them like our GPS regularly. And just to say, I love maps. I like my GPS, but I also like physical maps, and I'm never happier than when I'm in the passenger seat going on a road trip with several paper maps in my lap. So I love maps of consciousness, and I love maps of spiritual paths, and I love maps to help me and stimulate me and evoke understanding. So I have some idea of the territory we're on, some bit of explanation. And certainly Buddhism provides a variety of maps or different ways of understanding this path of being human. In one simple way, it's often described as a journey from confusion to awakening. A journey from misunderstanding to clarity. A journey from misperception, the misperception of separation, to the experience of connection and interbeing. And then just a side comment, we can certainly see how the misperception, the misunderstanding, the confusion about separation is plaguing our planet right now, the sense of disconnection and the actions and behaviors that come out of that disconnection and that lack of understanding of interbeing. So today I want to add another model to the mix to help us understand this journey from confusion to awakening. And this is a three-part developmental model from transpersonal psychology. I used to be a transpersonal psychologist and psychotherapist. And those of you familiar with transpersonal psychology know that it's influenced a lot by Buddhism, and certainly by the what's called the perennial philosophy or perennial wisdom traditions. So I'm going to share that model and use it as a way to help us see our direction and potential to help us understand our Dharma practice, where it's taking us a little better, and places or pitfalls we might have in misunderstanding our path. So this model refers it kind of to different stages of life, but it really refers to three stages that are happening simultaneously that are, depending what's going on in our life, we might find us more experiencing more the characteristics of one stage than the other. So this is the model of pre-personal, personal, and transpersonal, and this model might be familiar to some of you. I'm smiling because of the weird feeling of the microphone. I'm trying to look around at everybody and not be distracted by the microphone. So we'll start with the pre-personal. And the pre-personal refers to the period of life when our personhood is actually just forming, being created, developing, the development of this person, of each of you persons, of identity, of personality. And it's called pre because it's before that's sort of hardened or solidified. You could say this is from the womb to adolescence, but it's particularly the younger years. By probably 10 years of age, we're starting to get into the second phase. So this phase, the prepersonal, is when we're subject to the earliest events and experiences and relationships that form our self-view. This self-view is very important. It informs our relationship style, our worldview. It's where we develop our neuroses and defenses, our limited ways of thinking, behaving, reacting. It's all the beliefs about ourselves, and we carry this through our entire life to some degree. And over a period of time, we become freer from it, hopefully. And sort of our gross level of patterns of suffering are kind of put into place here. And the basic question that we deal with is, am I safe or not? Can I connect or not? So this can translate into chronic, recurring unhappiness. Many of you may have some experience with that. Things like feelings of loneliness or isolation, not belonging, shame, depression, anxiety, all the fearful states, sense of inadequacy, difficulties in relationships, conflict, difficulties in intimacy, and so forth. Again, these are sort of ground zero for the ways in which we often suffer in a human life. And it's very common for people to have experienced some form of trauma early on that also defines how we see ourselves in the world. This is the whole area also known as the shadow, because it's all the feelings and beliefs and experiences that we tend to want to push away, we tend to not want to see or feel or know. Either that, or we see and feel and know them more than we like. It's usually one or the other. So our job as adults is to foster the healing of this pre-personal experience. Repair what was broken, what was mishandled and hurt, the deficits we experienced in self-acceptance and receiving love and in feeling confidence and intimacy. And in this realm, well, before I go on, what I'm going to do is apply to each of these stages our fundamental Dharma practice. And I think we can talk about it in a very simple and direct way. And I like to talk about it in terms of the two wings of the bird of Dharma. And this is a little quiz, pop quiz. I know many of you are very familiar with the two wings, but anybody, what are the two wings? The two wings of Dharma?
Wisdom and compassion.
Wisdom and compassion? Is that what I heard? Okay, great. So I'm going to apply wisdom and compassion to each of these stages and emphasize how our wisdom is translated as the practice of mindfulness. It's how we develop wisdom in a basic way. And in terms of compassion, it's our metta, our compassion practices, our metta practices, all of those heart opening and healing practices that we do. And this mindfulness and our metta practices are indispensable for each of these stages. But they're different. And how they come to play is a little different. And what the effect is a little different. I just want to say about the two wings of the bird, as I was writing this, and I had the image of a condor. Last spring I saw my first condor. And I was at Pinnacles National Park. And I had gone on a hike by myself, and I saw my first condor. It was kind of in the distance, flying over some of the pinnacles. And I was really excited, and I was ready to head down and just saw it before I headed down. So it came and it went, it came and it went, and then I waited and I waited and I waited, and I'm like, okay, that was it. And I guess I'll go down now. And just as I turned to go down, two condors flew, you know, maybe like 20 feet, 15, 20 feet above me. Oh. And this enormous wingspan. And so I think of the power and the breath and the soaring capabilities of those wings in terms of the two wings of the Dharma. So mindfulness in the pre-personal level is, as I said, indispensable. It's necessary for our healing because we need to be able to apply that mindfulness to what we feel, to going through our traumas, to giving ourselves the space to be with what's really there, to identify and recognize the patterns of behavior and reactivity that developed from that experience, and to bring the mindfulness to all the areas, to the shadow, to what we've avoided and what we've been fearing, what we've repressed for a lifetime. And self-compassion and loving kindness also is essential. You know, I worked as a therapist for many years, transpersonal therapist, and I thought often two things I'm going to say, my work, a lot of it seemed to be helping people create a vessel, what I called a vessel of loving kindness, a way to actually hold themselves and their experience with a sense of tenderness and kindness. And the other piece I want to say is, being a therapist, is that those who came to therapy with an awareness practice, with some skill and development of mindfulness, could take much better advantage of the process, because they were already tuned into the value of being aware. So our wounding from this level is usually relational in some way. And so this loving kindness and compassion toward the pain and the hurt and the shame and the vulnerability and the confusion that might have arise or might still arise is so basic and so necessary. But I want to say, as I'm sort of ending this part of Our practice at this level may not be enough. People want our practice to transform, like a magic wand, this part of our wounding. And usually it's essential but not enough. There's a wonderful article which I actually brought a copy of and I recommend to everybody. It's called, it's from Jack Kornfield. You can Google it, find it online. This is one of the points I want to make. And the title of it is, Even the Best Meditators Have Old Wounds to Heal. In many ways, our Dharma practice was not created with this in mind, with healing these kind of wounds. So we often have to find other helping hands to navigate this difficulty and the pain and the hurt that we've experienced. The other thing I want to say is I find that many people who have not really yet repaired enough or dealt with enough or been able to be with enough this wounding don't really grow in their Dharma practice. That it's a major, because of the nature of Dharma practice is you have to open and let go. And yet all our wounding says don't open, don't let go. And so it's important to do a lot of healing. These all happen simultaneously. But this is an encouragement, and this is a prod, and this is a something important I want to say to all of you. And you could say that these unrepaired, undealt with, unhealed wounds are what's actually causing so much of fear and anger and hatred we see today in people's lives, in the world. So we need to do our own piece. So the next level that we go into is the personal level. Is everybody with me? Okay. You might have a lot of questions about what I just talked about, and hopefully we'll be able to get back to that. But I kind of want to go through this before I open it up more. So we have the personal level, which is where most of us spend most of our time. And Freud called this the realm of work and love. Or I might say relationships and livelihood. It's the realm of being effective in managing daily affairs, responsibilities of human life, emotional life. And here the task is learning and skill building, maturing as a human. And includes all the skill building of mindfulness and many things we have in practice. So here mindfulness increases the power of awareness to see options, to help self-regulate, to tolerate discomfort, to learn impulse control, all these fun things, to recognize the consequences of our actions. And loving kindness and metta is we start to learn that it's not just about me. It's really about friends and family and community. And we ideally learn in this stage about ethics and integrity, being good citizens, and a helpful part of our community. But this is still very much the realm of self and identity and personality and remaining loyal to our identity, our opinions, our habits, our patterns, our neuroses. And I might ask you, how loyal are you to your patterns and neuroses? This is the realm still of what in Buddhism is called Sakyaditi, self-view, where we see through the lens of self. We may be learning and growing and expanding, which is great, important, necessary, but we're still doing it from the vantage point of our limited view of self. So in this, you know, phase, hopefully we're having more insight into who we are and what the world is about. Hopefully we're gaining greater flexibility in who we are and how we relate. But we also may be gaining in rigidity and stronger defenses, control issues. Anne Lamott says, I appreciate this. She says, we know our spiritual practice is working as if in crisis and difficulty and loss, we become softer and more open instead of harder and more closed. So that's a good way of assessing how your spiritual practice is going. So many of the Dharma teachings and lists really kind of relate to this level. I would say the Dharma was built for this level. It wasn't built so much for the pre-personal. They didn't sort of relate to our childhood trauma in those days, especially the childhood trauma of the West, of the modern human. But here, there's a lot to help us navigate the complexities of this level. Give us instructions on how to behave, what qualities are important. That's the paramis, for example, the lists. We learn at this level what I call the kindergarten of wisdom. Basic understanding of what leads to greater relief of suffering, what leads to greater understanding, what leads to more depth, what leads to more open heart, and an understanding of what leads to more conflict and difficulty and more suffering. So we learn at this level about sila, that's our integrity, the precepts to live in harmony with others. We learn about the Eightfold Path. You could say much of the Dharma teachings are preparing us for the next stage, in the stage of true liberation. And that's the stage I'm interested in. I'm interested in all these. That's the stage I'm interested in. And I'm interested in navigating that transition for people and how they get stuck navigating that. And this is where the Dharma excels and truly shines. So the transpersonal, so what, this is a question, what is, in this context, what do you think the prefix trans means?
Transform.
What?
Transform.
Transform, not quite.
Transition.
Across.
Mm-hmm. Beyond. Beyond. I'm using it in the sense of beyond or bigger than. So it's beyond or bigger than the personal. And if you've been studying the Dharma for a while, you know that this is essential to the Buddhist teaching. This is the second noble truth, where freedom, we get hooked and confused and into patterns of suffering through our misidentification of self, our misunderstanding of who we are. So this, in the trans, what's called the transpersonal, is when the personality, we begin to expand beyond that. We're not so identified with it. So I'm going to say some things about the transpersonal. Is the sound still okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That may seem broad and vague. I hope not, but it's kind of broad and vague. Because it starts to touch on what's beyond our normal understanding or our normal ways of categorizing. So in this, the so-called transpersonal phase, or when we start to be released from the ego self, and it is released from the ego self doesn't go away, It's just that it's not the center of things anymore. And believe me, well, believe me, I'm still caught in my ego self a lot. And also, believe me, when I'm not, it's such a relief and it's so liberating. So the ego self is not the driver, or not the driver all the time. So the final task here, the first task was healing, second task was skill building, and now the third task is waking up. Third task is waking up. It's the task of release. It's the task of liberation. So I found this quote. It's attributed to several people, so I don't know who said it originally, but awakening is not changing who you are, but discarding who you are not. Does that make sense to people? Do you understand this? Awakening is not changing who you are, but discarding what you are not. And as I like to say, it's a case, our non-awakened state is a case of mistaken identity. And I want to add too that we all have these, as I said earlier, all this is happening kind of every day in concert. The pre-personal, we get triggered. We're all upset about something. We feel terrible about ourselves. We feel guilty, shame. Then we're doing the daily tasks of our life, effectively or not so effectively, but we're falling through that. And then we might have moments of just peacefulness or openness when that the onslaught of our identified conditioned mind just opens for a little bit. Maybe we're at nature, in nature somewhere. So it's this one, being human is this incredible mix of all of these, and they don't they aren't separate, and they don't, one doesn't inhibit the other. So often we have, and you can explore this for yourself, a little bit of resistance to this stage, or a little sense of non-recognition is a sort of a classic or technical term. But I think we all long for it so much. We long for this so much. Do you know what I'm saying? We long for this place where we're not burdened by our continual self-critic. We long for this place where we feel expansive. And even in a variety of situations, we feel connected. We feel inwardly safe. We long for this because this is our true home. This is who we are. All that other stuff is a creation. It's there. It's a story we create. It's a story that we often are committed to, loyal to, as I said, and yet there's more. And so as we become more and more unhooked from the self story, we become more awake, more aware, and more alive. This is a poem from Hafiz. We should make all spiritual talk simple today. God is trying to sell you something, but you don't want to buy. That is what your suffering is. Your fantastic haggling, your manic screaming over price. So we struggle with the price of awakening, or what we think the price of awakening is. We struggle over with what we think the price of freedom is, with the price of giving up our neuroses, loyalty to our neuroses. I'm not sure we ever give up our neuroses, but we give up a lot of loyalty to them. So this is when we have moments and more moments of not of waking up out of the trance. Tara Brach uses that term a lot. Other people do. I really like it. It's like we're in this trance and confined, limited beliefs, confined sense of self, an assumed, what I call assumed or consensus reality that's very narrow and unpleasant, really, much of the time. So we move from the story of separation into the experience of inner being. What I call the mystical ecological view. The ecological view is that everything's connected in nature, in the universe, and that's what we discover. And from John Muir, one of my heroes, see, one of your heroes? John Muir said wisely, when one tugs at a single thing in nature, one finds it attached to the rest of the world. So here, mindfulness, the practice of wisdom, reveals how the heart and mind actually works in a very fundamental and universal way. We begin to actually be aware of awareness itself. We begin to be aware of the unconditioned state. What's not the personality? What's not all our thoughts? What's not all that, the habits? As said early, it's what we are not. It's a willingness to end the struggle with reality. It's a willingness to be with everything. And loving kindness is what also gives us. Loving kindness, wisdom, and compassion become one bird at this point. And our heart goes beyond family, friends, community to everything. And this means greater ability to step into the eternal unknown, which is where we are. Step into the mystery of being. As some of you know, my most current motto that I think about every day is from Carl Sagan, which goes, as the small creatures that we are, the vastness is only bearable through love. As the small creatures that we are. The vastness, you could say the mystery, the unknown, the openness, the expanse, the wonder, the incredibleness is only bearable through love. So you might be thinking, now, how do I get more of this transpersonal thing? Well, on one hand, we have opportunities all the time. On the other hand, it's not something we can make happen. Again, it's not a doing, it's an undoing. You know, the pre-personal and the personal tasks are really a lot about doing things, skill building, as I said, healing, this and that. This is the undoing in the most positive way possible. But what we can do is create the conditions that are more likely to open us up. What we can do is make, what I like to say, is make ourselves available. And more we go from this ego-based identity to what I call the awareness-based presence. Awareness-based presence. Do you have a sense of what that's like? And it's through dedicated, sincere practice, curiosity, and courage. And I, this isn't always so welcomed, but it's sometimes existential crises are helpful. Those are the heavenly messengers. And the world is in one big existential crisis right now. Can we allow that to waken us up, our hearts, our willingness to be present, to be witnesses? So I feel my job as a teacher is to encourage you, to inspire you, to nudge you, to evoke reflection on this, self-assessment. So I'm going to go on to a couple more conclusions, maybe. But I hope so far this might have been helpful, a reflection in your own sense of your personal experience, your personal life, and your own familiarity or experiences with what I'm calling the transpersonal. I'm looking at the time, so I'm okay. So I said in the beginning that we have some people often get a little bit confused or lost or make mistakes around on the path, and that this model can help bring us some clarity. Again, I recommend you read Jack Kornfield's article. There's a lot of other material out there. But where I see students run into trouble is that they actually, this is spiritual bypassing. So I recommend you go to that day long if you're interested. People don't do the work of healing. They don't do the work of facing their demons and their hurt and their trauma. And they want to jump ahead into the transpersonal and forget about it, the rest of it. That's spiritual bypassing. It doesn't work. As they say, the only way there is through. The only way there is to be aware of everything, to be willing to be mindful of all aspects of our experience, our heart. And this is where you see a lot of spiritual communities and teachers become very dysfunctional because they haven't dealt with their issues. Also, people can compartmentalize, get very good at awareness in this area and not in other areas. So I invite you to consider that for yourself. Also, there's a lot of people who feel like the so-called wounding issues are not important. What's really important is the spiritual path, and I can tell you the path is not separate from that. And if you're not willing to be present with it all, you will suffer. Also, I see that people use the power, can you actually use the power of mindfulness and concentration to more deeply entrench their defenses and their unwillingness to be present with certain experiences. They get better at suppressing the shadow side of aspects of themselves. So again, I implore you to commit to the shining light of mindfulness and awareness for the whole experience of being human. This is from Jack. Mindfulness works only when we are willing to direct attention to every area of our suffering. Are you willing? Are you game? We need helping hands to do this. This is no small thing. This is big. This is really big. This is what Robert Thurman calls evolutionary sport. This is inviting us to access and bring out of dormancy our evolutionary potential, which is what awakening is. It's what our potential is, but humans are not so good at it yet. But it's been happening for a few thousand years to some people, and it's part of, you're here, so it's part of what you're doing. One other quick comment, and then we will have a few minutes for comments and questions. The other place I see people get stuck is they get really comfortable. They may be in pain, but still really comfortable with the personal level. Actually, I see that true of almost everybody. And hold back from really committing oneself to going beyond everything we've invested in this personality and in our identity. It's hard to do that. One of my teachers, Sotni Rinpoche, calls this becoming a master of samsara. Meaning you get pretty good at living this life. You know, you suffer some, but you're somewhat competent, you're somewhat comfortable, you have enough. And but you have stopped. He sees that people then stop on the path and stop investigating our full potential and what the path is really asking of us and what the path can really offers, what the Dharma, what the Buddha really offers. So Jack says, and I quote him again, we need to look at our whole life and ask ourselves, where am I awake and what am I avoiding? Do I use my practice to hide? In what areas am I conscious and where am I fearful, caught, or unfree? So we take on our whole life, all the nooks and crannies of ourself. We bring compassion and a deep love and curiosity. And we offer that to others as well. So, having said that, I got through it. Again, I hope that it's triggered something of interest for you. So we have a little bit of time for questions or comments. Any questions or comments from the crowd? Yes, way back there.
I'm Susan again.
Make sure you talk loud enough.
Okay. It's wild because before I knew...
I can't.
Oh, yeah. Before I knew we were going to be talking about spiritual bypass, I was in a moment where, when is spiritual bypass kind of useful because the mind is going to a not great place? I mean, it's not quite spiritual bypass. That's, I was kind of pondering how to tell the difference when I'm bypassing or when I'm bringing something about to soothe myself, perhaps.
Well, we all are unaware of lots of aspects of ourselves a lot of the time. So I wouldn't say that's necessarily a bypass. That's just the nature of the game and who we are as we practice. And so a bypass is more of a commitment to avoiding than just the... And there's usually a belief system around a bypass that I shouldn't feel or I can't. We do need to be very... I'm very interested, actually, in trauma and how much trauma is difficult, makes practice difficult. And so I just want to address that we need to be very tender and paced slowly with the difficult places. So I'm not saying in this we run out and try to feel everything right now. Please, Everybody, be very gentle and slow and kind. And that's the words. And we still need to be committed to it. But gentle, slow, kind. And so that's not bypass. That's wisdom.
I think the word came from me was titrated.
What?
Titrating.
Titrating, pendulating, titrating. Yes. Yes. And we need to, I mean, that's a whole big conversation. We need to be respectful of ourselves in the process. And mainly what I'm saying here, too, is just to give people encouragement and inspiration to be in the process, not to hurry it up. And it's what I said from the beginning, to get helping hands in the process, because we can't really do that alone. We can't do any of this alone. And yeah, is that
absolutely.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I want to say, here I am, 66 years old, and you know, I'm still working with a lot of that stuff. It's like at a different level, but it's still that stuff, still deeper, more insight, still more places of compassion to find, still more fears to discover, and still great love to hold it with, to discover, to hold it with. So yeah. Yeah. Anybody else? Yes, Emily.
When you talked about like healing, skill building, and what was it?
Awakening.
If we have a ton of work to do on healing and just skill building, should we not even approach the third? Like, can you do them all at the same time? Or, yeah, what are your thoughts?
Absolutely. My concern is only that we get we don't do them all of them, you know, and so that we try to jump to the transpersonal, or that we forget the transpersonal. So yes, absolutely. I mean, I started this Dharma practice when I was 22, really jumped into it, long retreats and everything else, and it really helped me on all three levels. Particularly what I said, learning to be present, mindful, helps with the pre-personal work. Compassion, self-compassion, it helps so much. And you learn that so much more deeply, I have found, in Dharma-related. I mean, there's a lot of ways you can learn that. And go for it, whatever way works for you. But this is certainly one way to learn it very deeply. And then the skill building, again, of just ordinary life, you know, learning a career, but also the Dharma offers ways to learn about how to do that more helpfully, how to relate more helpfully in community and so forth. And then moments of openness or expansiveness that we might have as a 22-year-old for me or whatever, give insight and clarity. You know, they don't last that long, usually, but they help us. They give us confidence in a deeper sense of who we are and what this path is. So part of what I want to communicate is this, the beauty of the arc of this path, the possibility of this, and that we're all on this journey, and it's an incredible journey, and it's difficult, and it's wonderful. Is that helpful?
Yeah.
So go for it, Emily.
Do we have time for me to ask the follow-up?
Yeah, we're going over a little bit. Just.
Oh, that's okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. I've experienced some conflict between trying to work with therapists and do Dharma practice. Uh-huh. Like, they're getting me more and more and more into my story and into uh-huh. my, you know, personality, and Dharma's kind of asking me to do the opposite. Do you find there's certain methods of therapy or healing that mm-hmm. are more compatible?
Well, that's a bigger, I don't know if people heard it, she's saying that what appears to be a conflict between therapy and Dharma at times, and at times there might be. That's a big, I mean, a lot more. But what I'll say is there is therapy that is based in awareness. And it's totally congruent with this. But we do have to address our story. We don't have to be stuck in it, but we have to address it. Or it will drive us. It will run the show unless we face it. So there is a way in which we have to do it, but it's different than being... So a good question. Okay, so let's... Thanks, everybody. And so let's just end for today. And I'll do a little dedication together. So allow everything that's been said and thought about and felt, just let it all be. You're just here with senses, the flow of sense, the flow of sound, the flow of feelings, the flow of thoughts, the flow of awareness, the flow of breath. And using this openness and flow as an opportunity to extend appreciation and gratitude for your own journey, for the journey of each person here, for the mystery and journey of all beings everywhere. And may we dedicate our efforts, even our mishaps, to the benefit of all beings. So all beings learn about their interbeing, so that all beings learn about the two wings of wisdom and compassion, so that all beings begin to connect with the possibility and depth of their own freedom. I'll be here for a few minutes if anybody has a question.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.